In re Rebecca Ballard, Director, Central State Hospital Physician, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Alice P. Armstrong, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Brady J. Curtis, Assistant Attorney General, James F. Pentis, Assistant Attorney General for the Petitioner, John P. O'Herron, William W. Hunter, David Penn, Gustin for the Respondent.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, Alice Armstrong on behalf of Dr. Vauder, Director of Central State Hospital. Your Honor, if I may, I would like to try to reserve 4 minutes.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was preparing for argument, it occurred to me that, as is sometimes my wont, perhaps I was a little too far down in the weeds on this case, but I think the answer to the question lies in the prayer for relief that was asserted in the Dinwiddie Circuit Court, which was a request that the Dinwiddie Circuit Court direct the Circuit Court of Alexandria to dismiss the indictment with prejudice. It is respectfully submitted that there is no authority in the habeas corpus statutes or anywhere else for a court of equal dignity to direct the Alexandria Circuit Court to do anything, frankly, but certainly there is no authority to direct the Alexandria Circuit Court to dismiss a criminal indictment.
Well, that would be pretty substantial error if the trial court did that, but it wouldn't necessarily be a breach of subject matter jurisdiction, would it?
I think it would, because I think there's no authority to do it. There is no subject matter in the circuit court to direct a court of equal dignity to do anything. There is no authority for the court to take such an action. And I don't think the bare question of subject matter jurisdiction in general answers the question, because the cases speak to an encroachment or an excess of jurisdiction, not simply an absence of some.
So many of the cases use the term jurisdiction in sort of the old-fashioned way, which is loose.
Well, yes, they do, but they also, those old cases, I think, hit on the point, which is the purpose, the role, the function, the office of the writ of prohibition is any time the court is acting outside of its own. I think one of the cases actually talks about channels or jurisdiction channeling things. Anytime you're outside your own cognizance, then prohibition will lie. And it's respectfully suggested that the Dinwiddie Circuit Court would be outside its cognizance to act, because the relief sought, habeas corpus relief, belongs to the cognizance of another court. It doesn't belong to Dinwiddie. And the subject matter jurisdiction of the circuit courts in habeas corpus is controlled solely by statute. This court has constitutional authority to issue such a writ.
But is it controlled solely by statute? I mean, there's all kinds of doctrines like the EC case or Slayton versus Paragon, where the court has, I mean, there's this whole common law background and there's a statutory overlay. So is it strictly a creature of statute?
I think the circuit court authority to issue that is a creature of statute, and it's not covered in the general statutory grant of the circuit court's authority in 17.1513.
And what I'm trying to figure out is, I mean, we're in this prohibition silo, which is pretty narrow.
It is.
And the circuit court hasn't ruled on the petition. It's just ruled that it has authority to rule, right? In other words, it hasn't granted a writ of habeas corpus or denied a writ of habeas corpus.
Correct. And
right. So what I'm wondering is if we were to determine hypothetically that it does have jurisdiction, that wouldn't preclude, if the court then denies the writ, it's moot and it goes away. And maybe the petitioner can appeal and you can assign cross error as a matter of legal error to the court's authority. If the court grants a writ, you can appeal. And then we have that authority to circumscribe, as we did in Slayton versus Paragon, to say, look, this doesn't make any sense to have a state official caught in the crossfire of dueling orders and to police the lower court's authority to. So that's what I'm struggling with. I'm sympathetic to the dilemma that your client has about this prospect of irreconcilable series of orders, but on the other hand, I'm struggling with whether prohibition is the way to get at the problem.
Right, and I think that the Gorrell case, which I think we only cited in the petition for a hearing, but the Gorrell case talks about when the right of appeal isn't a fulsome enough remedy. Right, I obviously prohibition can only be had prospectively.
Right.
It's clear that prohibition does not lie to undo something that was done incorrectly. So, and my understanding from the case law is that the proper way to proceed is to first to suggest to the court that it does not have jurisdiction, which we did. But this is the only remedy right now to prevent the further mischief of...
Right, but I mean, and if... I mean, the court seems to be accommodating in terms of allowing you to proceed in this way and not, you know, holding off on ruling. So perhaps if it reached a conclusion that the writ should lie, it might stay its hand and allow you to get the answer on appeal as to whether that was proper or not.
And it may, but, and if, I mean, obviously this is an extraordinary writ that we are seeking, but this is an extraordinary case, and these circumstances are somewhat extraordinary. In the run of things, I mean, in the run of things, if it were the jailer or the director of the Department of Corrections, although no one wants to be held in contempt, I am aware, I understand that sometimes parties tactically put themselves in that situation because that would be an immediately appealable.
We just dealt with it.
Pardon?
We just dealt with that this summer.
Correct. That would be an immediately appealable order, but the problem for my client is she holds a professional license, and she might be subject to disciplinary proceedings, notwithstanding that the court might or might not be willing to stay its hand in this situation. But the larger concern, I think, is that it's not just specific to this case. I mean, the trial court's, the respondent's reading of this statute, I think when we look at, when we put the Booker overlay on the reading of the statute, it's not just this extraordinary case that would be affected. Under the respondent's reading of the statutory scheme, any litigant, any person who had been revoked could go anywhere in the Commonwealth. I mean, Mr. Murphy, the habeas corpus petitioner, didn't suggest that expansive a reading of the statute. Mr. Murphy suggested that Dinwiddie was appropriate because that's where he was physically being held. And when we look at 37.2845A, that has a lot of initial intuitive appeal. It makes sense. That's how one would proceed if it were a civil commitment. But when you look at B, 37.2845B, I think it actually sheds light on this, which is if it's a civil commitment pursuant to the Sexually Violent Predator Act, and not just an adjudication, but also a finding under the same statute that's at issue here, 19.2169.3, you have to go to the trial court. You have to go back to the original jurisdiction where all the prior proceedings were had.
Well, why can't both of you be partly right? There is subject matter jurisdiction, but obviously there's no venue under your theory.
Right.
So a court can erroneously conclude there's venue, and it comes up on direct appeal, and it gets reversed, and then every court in the state for the next 100 years knows they don't have venue. But prohibition is, I just don't understand why it's necessary for a pure venue question. Territorial jurisdiction to me is just venue. Am I wrong?
Well, I think there is more to it than that, but I also think that under 8.01654, the territorial jurisdiction and the subject matter jurisdiction are interdependent because 8.01654B1 speaks in terms of the court's authority to issue the writ. And so I don't think that they can be decoupled in the same way that a generic venue question
might
apply.
A court that has subject matter jurisdiction but does not have proper venue, improper venue, doesn't have authority to go forward. But if they go forward in error, they get reversed on appeal no matter what they come up with as a result.
Right, and this court has said that prohibition will still lie if the right of appeal isn't sufficiently fulsome or doesn't completely remedy the problem that we're getting at. And part of the problem in this case is, I mean, why do we want to stop this in its tracks? Maybe I would prevail on appeal and maybe that would be okay, but the reason we want to stop it is why should the director or any other agent of the Commonwealth be called upon to marshal all the resources? Because what's actually happening in this case...
But couldn't every civil defendant say the same thing when venue is obviously wrong and the trial court, for whatever reason, wants to press forward anyway? We don't give interlocutory appeals. There's no Cohen collateral order doctrine. There is no prohibition. They just have to suffer through it and then win on appeal.
And can seek expedited review and so on.
Right, I understand. But this court just said this summer that if the appellate remedy isn't sufficiently fulsome, and I suggest that it is not, then this court will entertain the extraordinary writ.
I guess the question I keep asking myself is, I haven't gone through every single site that the two of you have done, but I went through a lot of them, and I didn't see any of the jurisdiction sites to be venue or territorial jurisdiction. They were all subject matter jurisdiction, power questions, as opposed to appropriate use of power questions.
Well, but as I said before, I don't think that just simply the question of subject matter jurisdiction answers the question, because in N. Ray Robert F. Horan, the trial court indisputably had subject matter jurisdiction over the criminal proceeding, but entered an order in excess of the court's authority because it encroached on the constitutional right of the Commonwealth attorney to seek a particular punishment. So I don't think that just simply saying the court has subject matter jurisdiction, bare subject matter jurisdiction, necessarily answers the question when the court is nevertheless acting outside the confines of what the legislature has set up. The legislature has made very clear, I submit, through the statutory scheme, that when criminal process is involved at any stage, because the SVP statutes apply even when there has not been a conviction, right? If the sexually violent predator is unrestorably incompetent, there is a commitment proceeding, and if he seeks habeas corpus, he still has to go back to the court where the criminal process originated. So the statutory scheme, when you view the entire body of law in peri matera, the statutory scheme says the legislature's intent is to cabin these cases into the court where the process originated, where the record lies, and where everyone can be heard. I mean, part of the problem in this case is we're not writing on a blank slate. This case has an extremely long history. This isn't a fixed situation. This is not the run-of-the-mill habeas corpus case, because usually the proceedings have finished. I mean, in the ordinary course, the proceedings in the trial court have concluded, and there's something fixed. This thing is organic. It keeps going. There was a hearing last week.
And he's filed multiple habeas petitions. This one just be straightforwardly barred as successive?
Well, I don't think successive for this reason, and we didn't assert a successive writ bar, because he is challenging a specific order that arose after a change in circumstance, and so I don't think that will be well taken. It did occur to me that, you know, maybe the claim is nevertheless not cognizable, but I don't think that that is something that we reach on a jurisdictional point. The court always has jurisdiction to say whether a claim is cognizable or not. And if I may, I would like to reserve.
I've got a question for you, counsel.
Certainly.
I noticed neither party mentioned 37.2-844. Are you familiar with that?
I am, and as I alluded, I did. I assume it's before the court, but perhaps it's not. I did cite to 845 in my petition for rehearing.
So does that inform your, or should that inform us any in dealing with the issue you were talking about before?
Yes, I think it does. I think it absolutely reinforces the contention that because 844 says any court of competent jurisdiction, but then when you look at 845, it tells us what the competent court, that court of competent jurisdiction is. And if you're asking for a general review of a civil commitment, the court of competent jurisdiction is the circuit court where the facility is located, where the petitioner is housed, or the neighboring jurisdiction. But if it's a civil commitment under the Sexually Violent Predator Act, then the petitioner must go to the trial court where the last predicate offense occurred, or where the trial court adjudicated him unrestorably incompetent under 19.2.169.3, I believe it's E.
Close enough.
D or E. But in every event, in every circumstance, the legislature has signaled that when criminal process has been involved, no matter where you are on the continuum here, when criminal process is involved, you have to go back to the court where the process issued.
You have 38 seconds remaining.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John O'Haron, on behalf of the respondent, and joining me today is my colleague David Gustin. Because we are in the silo of a writ of prohibition, the only relevant inquiry here is subject matter jurisdiction. Territorial jurisdiction and venue is not appropriate for the extraordinary writ of prohibition.
Suppose you're right on that. What would be the authority that says that as clearly as you just said?
So in developing this case and sort of unusual circumstances in this case being brought here, I did find a case very recently. It's 198 Virginia 100, and I intend to file a Rule 5-6 letter with this supplemental authority and a couple other cases. But the court in this case, it's a 1956 case, County School Board versus Honorable Harold Sneed. It is a prohibition case, and the court talks about venue versus subject matter jurisdiction and states, prohibition does not lie to compel a change of venue or prevent the circuit court from proceeding with the trial on the ground it was not instituted in the proper form. And I think the court's rationale is that venue is something you can waive. Subject matter jurisdiction is not something that you can waive. And because of the extraordinary writ of prohibition, we are in the realm of subject matter jurisdiction, not territorial.
Well, can I ask a related question? Yeah. Assuming it's venue only, territorial jurisdiction, assuming prohibition doesn't lie, why go forward? Why not just transfer the case to the Northern Virginia court so that you don't have to deal with the possibility of winning in Dinwiddie and then getting reversed on appeal?
And that gets to what was going to be my next point, which is that this is not the only remedy. If the question is venue and whether this case should be rather than can be in the Dinwiddie Circuit Court, they can move to transfer venue. The only issue that Judge Seller ruled on was under the statutory jurisdiction.
Right. Would you object to that?
Presupposed
jurisdiction exists for purposes of entering a venue transfer order.
I don't know whether Judge
One suspects your client would rather be in Dinwiddie since he's attacking the order that the Alexandria judge entered. Presumably he doesn't want to be in Alexandria.
I think that's probably correct. But the question in this case is, and the only question that Judge Seller ruled on, was whether he had subject matter jurisdiction to entertain the petition for writ of habeas corpus,
but
not whether it was appropriate or not.
Does your implicit concession, which I find no fault with whatsoever, reinforce the idea that how would the General Assembly want that to happen? One circuit court basically looking over the shoulder of another circuit court and essentially reviewing the action collaterally, or in your analysis of any circuit judge, you just pick the one you want out throughout the whole Commonwealth who has a problem with this particular scenario. That doesn't strike me as what the legislature intended.
I think that's probably correct. I think they probably didn't intend that. And I think the history of 654, again, preparing for the argument and looking at that statute a little more, that what is now 654 used to just be subsection A. It used to just say any circuit court. And then in 1958, I believe it was, it added a subsection that said you could file wherever you were detained or whether the order of conviction was entered. In 1962, this court ruled in a case called Walker v. Brooks, which in advance of the argument I did share with opposing counsel. It's not cited in our brief and in our initial brief in opposition. But in that case, it was a non-criminal habeas. The grandmother filed the habeas petition in, I believe it was Hanover, seeking custody of her grandchildren that were in Louisa, and the mother objected on the same grounds that we're sort of talking about here. And Justice Carrico, writing for the court, said that the 1958 amendments, the language regarding order of conviction, did not affect non-criminal cases. And he used the term held under criminal process, which then 6 years later the General Assembly added to that subsection. I believe those amendments were in 1968. And so you've always had subsection A, what is now subsection A, talking about any circuit court. And as time has gone on, you've seen amendments from the General Assembly, and after this court's decision, adding those terms held under criminal process, defining certain parameters where something is different. And so in the cases where you have a judgment order of conviction, you have to file it in that court. Now, as currently written, 654B1 cannot apply here because there is no order of conviction. And that is an undisputed fact. Mr. Murphy has not been convicted by Alexandria. And so he cannot file a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the court in which he was convicted because he has not been convicted. So I think the term held under criminal process certainly applies here, and perhaps when the General Assembly put that in, it wasn't thinking of this sort of legal anomaly, whether it's, well, the SVP is different because you have a specific statute about where you can file a petition for writ of habeas corpus if you're under that process. But if you're under the statutes that Mr. Murphy is under regarding incompetency, you are held under criminal process. The term's not defined in the statutes, but we don't disagree with that conclusion. But it makes no sense for that. That subsection can't apply because he hasn't been convicted. And so Judge Sella ruled correctly that 654A is the appropriate jurisdictional statute and says any circuit court. And because he has, because the Dinwiddie Circuit Court has subject matter jurisdiction under that statute, just as the Dinwiddie Circuit Court would have jurisdiction over a custody of children habeas petition.
Well, what about the excess power cites and cases? As an analogy, when a circuit court enters a sentence in excess of a criminal statute, this court has construed it as void ab initio to the extent of the excess, and the underlying rationale is the court has no jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, to violate the statute that way. It's sort of a peculiar way to do the analysis, but that is clearly the law of Virginia. Why wouldn't the relief requested in this habeas petition be analogous to that by requesting relief that clearly would not be within the scope of a habeas court's power?
I think the question of whether a petition for writ of habeas corpus asks for appropriate relief, in other words, whether it falls within the parameters of an appropriate collateral attack. The director cited a couple cases, the general rule being that you can't collaterally attack in a different jurisdiction ruling over here. And we don't dispute that. Those cases are not habeas. Habeas is a collateral attack. You're allowed to do it under certain circumstances, required, you know, provided certain things are met.
Well, one thing to free someone from detention. It's another thing to dismiss indictments that grand juries have issued. That's a very different remedy than the typical habeas remedy.
I agree. And I think that if Mr. Murphy is requesting relief that he cannot, and whether that be because Dinwiddie has no jurisdiction, has no authority to tell Alexandria what to do, or whether because he should have appealed it, which he did not, that is a question of whether this is appropriate relief. It does not go to the subject matter jurisdiction of Dinwiddie, which is established under statute. And that has not been ruled on by the Dinwiddie Circuit Court. They have made no ruling, Judge Sella has made no ruling aside from the subject matter jurisdiction question. If Mr. Murphy is requesting inappropriate relief and Judge Sella gets that wrong, or another judge in the Dinwiddie Circuit Court gets that wrong, the director has other ways, as the colloquy earlier touched on, has other ways of obtaining relief from that error. And if that's the case, if that's the right premise, then prohibition cannot lie.
So in essence, you can't use a writ of prohibition as a motion for summary judgment?
Correct.
Or as a substitute for direct appeal.
Correct. Just as Mr. Murphy can't do it with habeas, the director can't do it with prohibition. If there's any other appropriate relief, if Mr. Murphy's improperly seeking habeas relief, they have other relief aside from prohibition, and under this court's case law, therefore, the extraordinary writ should not issue. I think without further questions, we'd ask the court to deny the writ. We think 654 establishes subject matter jurisdiction, and if that is the case, then prohibition cannot lie, and we ask the court to deny the director's petition.
Yeah, before you leave, if we were to deny it, it still would be without prejudice to the territorial jurisdiction venue point.
I think that's correct, yes.
Okay.
I think the only question here is subject matter jurisdiction in Dinwiddie. If the writ is denied, the other relief that we think the director has, they can then move to Plan B and C if you want. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Armstrong, you have 38 seconds.
So I think that it was just conceded that although the habeas corpus statute used to just say in any court, the legislature has acted to constrain that jurisdiction, and particularly so when criminal process is at issue. It is respectfully submitted that the Dinwiddie Circuit Court has no authority to proceed on a habeas corpus writ from someone who is held under criminal process and whose custody flows from that criminal process from the Alexandria Circuit Court, and we would ask the court to grant the writ. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case.